Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And thank goodness I have the assistance of Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick try to coordinate something called the Technical Net, which for the last 27 years, the Technical Net itself has been bringing amateurs together, gathering the clan, as I sometimes say, in which amateur radio operators help each other understand the way all of our equipment works. Wireless equipment is not simple. There's a lot to it. The schools only do a partial job of teaching it. Ham radio operators do an even better job, in my opinion, of teaching each other how antennas and transmitters and receivers and feed lines and all this other hardware, how does it all work? And the way it works and the way it's taught seems to be an extremely big difference between the two. Many an electrical engineer entering a college expects to have that knowledge when he leaves. With a bachelor degree, I don't think so. With a master's degree, he's got a little bit more of the knowledge. But still, if you haven't actually experimented with ham radio with your own hands, the way wireless equipment works will be an extreme mystery to you. As a ham radio operator, there'll still be some mystery involved, I'll warn you. But it's an exciting mystery. It's a interesting quest to try to figure out how it all works. What's Mother Nature really telling us when it comes to how does that signal propagate all of those thousands of miles when it comes to a very long-range DX operation on the United States and in the world, or when it comes to those millions and billions of miles that can be spanned with spacecraft? How in the world does that signal go that far without getting tired? And NASA's equipment, for instance, can be using their transponder that's on, for instance, a Mars orbiter 300 million miles away and give you a range accuracy that's measured in feet as far as the way the orbit of that spacecraft goes around Mars and whether or not the orbit deviates in 1 foot intervals, so to speak, so that you can detect the presence of a mass concentration on the portion of Mars that the satellite is now flying over. Just give you some example of what's possible. Or when you listen to an echo signal from Venus or Mars or the Moon or many other planets that have already been echoed. In other words, you send a radar signal there and wait a long period of time for the echo to come back and analyze that echo and figure out what's going on under the cloud cover of Venus, for instance. How in the world can radio do that? You read some of the NASA reports?
Repeater, timeout.
You read some of the NASA reports, you'll find out how NASA did it. You read some of the ham radio microwave enthusiast reports, you'll find out how they're doing somewhat similar things from time to time. There's a lot to it, as you can tell. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. And so the one you're listening to right now, 2-meter FM repeater, is just one of the types of ham radio, and there's many, many other kinds. So if this one doesn't completely tickle your fancy, before you give up the hobby, try one of the other 25. That's a suggestion. From time to time, Mel and I are kind of amazed at the letters we get and the reports that we hear that certain colleges are telling the professors are telling their students that they can get greater exposure to radio equipment technology by listening to this particular group of people and ham radio operators in general. A person signs into the Technical Net because he has a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, followed by your name, try to remember the name, and followed by the word yes. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. This is Technical Net number 1,284, and the net's been around for 27 and a quarter years. By now, we sort of assume that there are people out there listening, so you need not sign in if you're just telling us that you're listening. We're really looking for the people who have got a question or a comment for the net. So those people, please sign in right now. K2RIW listening.
Bob, W2OSR, and I do have a little something this evening, Dick.
This is Kilo Charlie 2 Tango Delta Lima, and my name is John, and yes, I do have a question.
So far I have Bob and John, and I think there was a double. Who was the other person?
Good evening, all. C2PEY.
Okay, that's Mel. So we've got Bob, John, and Mel. Anyone would like to sign into the technical end at this time with a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name.
Hi, this is Kate, Bill, and yes, I have a question.
Okay, Bill, please give me your call letters one more time.
K2SYL, the name is Bill, and yes, I have a question.
Okay, I think I heard K2SYL. Do I have that correct, Bill?
SYL.
Okay. I keep missing the prefix. Give me the prefix a few times. Is it K2, Bill? Go ahead.
KC2SYL.
Very fine, Bill. That's how we got it. On the input, I heard W2RLP. Maybe you don't have the PL tone turned on because you weren't coming through the output of the machine. And want to try again?
Whiskey 2, India, Lima, Papa, and it was Bob, go.
Very fine, Bob. And we certainly have you. And fascinating discussion we had last week. One last call. Anyone else to sign into the technical net? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
KC2MDP. Steve, no questions at this time.
Very fine. Steve with an L. All right, let's go to the first person who signed in. Mr. Secretary, remember when somebody used to be the president, you don't say the ex-president, you say Mr. President. So Mr. Secretary, Bob, W2OSR, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, well, good evening, Dick. This is W2OSR. Just got the latest issue of QSC, and we go to one of our favorite topics on the TechNet, antennas. There's an article in there about vertical antennas and ground plane systems for the vertical antennas. Just cutting to the quick, it appears based on what I read that the most effective way of putting the wires out for the ground plane is have them about 6 inches above the ground and no more than 10 radials. That seems to be the most effective method. So I don't know if you've seen the article or not, or you have any comments.
Very fine, Bob. All of us, are forgetting to wait for the beep. And Bob, your audio is a little bit low. We all heard you very well. Good signal, but audio is a little bit low. Yes, I got the latest issue of QST. I saw that beautiful article on ground plane radial systems. And they also mentioned, why can't I think of the guy's call letters now? Jerry Civic. Somebody tell me his call letters.
K2FMI.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mel. W2FMI. Jerry Civic and I, from time to time, were both on the same platform way back in the dark ages. And he did some extensive research on electrically small ground plane antennas in his backyard and investigating how extensive the ground plane radio system should be. Money drops. And so I didn't study the article as much as I'd like to yet. I'm going to be studying it some more, Bob. But the so-called counterpoise, the ground plane radial system, how much of that energy gets coupled into the Earth, and the Earth is a lossy item at HF frequencies. It is primarily a reflector, but it's not a perfect reflector. It's a lossy reflector. And so some of the signal gets coupled into the Earth, becomes a lost signal. As I see it, and this is my first guess as to what's going on, having not read the whole article yet, that if this is the best of all worlds, Bob and Dick would like to have a sheet of copper in the... And that sheet of copper, we'd like it to go a quarter of a mile in all directions with our ground plane radiator right in the middle. By definition, that would be an antenna with 100% efficiency. In other words, there are no lossy items anywhere. You've got a resonating radiator, and so every watt you put into that antenna is radiated into space somewhere. And depending on whether it's a 5/8 wave, quarter wave, half wave, or whatever radiator, will make some difference in the vertical elevation pattern, but that would be a lossless antenna. none of us have the resources to do that. So we're all going to put down some number of radials, ground plane radials. And so what's the right number? What's the right distance above the ground? Where do we get the biggest bang for the dollar? These are all very valid questions. And one way of looking at it, which I've sort of settled on, I guess a year or so ago, is to recognize the fact that you may think you've got a quarter wave ground plane antenna. You may think you have a rubber duck whip antenna of approximately quarter wave length electrical on your handy talkie. You may think you have a printed circuit antenna that is a printed inverted F antenna. That's what you may think is going on. Let me drop. What's really doing the radiating, from a simplistic point of view, and if you study many of the computer modeling programs, what's really going on? In a very elaborate process, they calculate how much current is flowing through each 16th of an inch, so to speak, of the components of the antenna. And once you know that current, you know how much magnetic field it creates. That magnetic field radiates into space. After a short distance in wavelengths, a fraction of a wavelength, or maybe a couple of wavelengths away from the antenna, Mother Nature takes that magnetic field, that cyclic magnetic field radiated by the current flowing in your antenna, straightens it all out, and eventually becomes a E and H field, electrostatic field and electromagnetic field, magnetic field and a voltage field, you could say, which are at right angles to each other, and that's what really gets radiated. But up close, many of the programs simply calculate what current is flowing in order to calculate what magnetic field that launches the whole process. It's a slightly simplistic way of looking at it, but it's effective and gives the right answers. However, you multiply the current and therefore the magnetic field by using resonance. What's magic about resonance? It means that your transmitter is sending energy down that transmission line. That energy becomes a charge, you could call it a ball of electrons if you like, walking down the wire of your antenna. That ball of electrons hits the end of the wire, reverses in direction, and comes back. And if you've got the right length of wire electronically, by electronically I mean the real length, let me drop, the real length for an 80-meter dipole, for instance, in free space or high enough above the ground, might be something in the vicinity of 132 feet long. That is a resonant half wavelength. That blob of energy, that ball of electrons that you've launched with the transmission line down that 132 feet of wire, 67 feet of wire in both directions, is going to bounce back and forth approximately 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated. You'd like to believe all the energy gets radiated when that ball of electrons walks down the wire once. You'd like to believe that. And many of the books you and I read lead you to believe that. Ain't true. You could say only 5% of the energy is radiated on the first pass. So there's going to be multiple passes. You're going to kick that signal in the tail, so to speak, that energy that you've launched on your antenna, 10 or 20 times before it finally leaves and goes into space. 5% of it on each bounce. What you and I call resonance is keeping all of those bounces co-phase, in step with each other. Because if they're out of step with each other, the current doesn't multiply. If the current doesn't multiply, you don't make a strong enough magnetic field. If you don't make a strong enough magnetic field, you don't radiate. So a half-wave dipole has this energy bouncing back and forth. That's the first step of the real radiating process. The second step of the process is to realize that if your balloning structure, and we've discussed balloons a little bit, and we're going to be discussing them a lot more, if your balloning structure between your transmission line and the antenna is working correctly, and if it's a sufficiently stealthy balloning structure, it's got that hair on its chest, so to speak, there's nothing magic about feeding the antenna in the center. You can feed it in the center, an eighth of a way away from the center, a quarter of the way, a half of the way from the center. You can feed it at one end, a half wavelength piece of wire, one single piece of wire, 132 feet long, fed at one end with the right kind of balloning structure and impedance matcher will give you the exact same performance as feeding it in the center with the feed line coming off at right angles. And if you're making a vertical antenna, making a halfway vertical and feeding it at the bottom end is a very convenient way. Rare antenna, it's not shown in the books, we don't know about that. So my point is, There's nothing magic about feeding it in any particular point if you've got the right impedance match and the right balancing structure. That's step number two. So to review, we've got energy bouncing back and forth on a half wavelength structure. We can feed the structure anywhere along the length if we're smart enough with the right kind of balancing structure. Step number three is to realize there's nothing magic about making the antenna, left side and right side, identical looking. We all do it that way because that's the diagram we've seen in the book. You can make the right-hand side of the dipole out of 8-gauge wire and the left side of the dipole out of 14-gauge wire. Properly fed, it'll give you essentially the identical performance. Make the left-hand side of the dipole fatter and fatter if you want to. Start changing its shape if you want to. And it becomes the ground plane structure, the so-called counterpoise. We think that quarter wave ground plane antenna is a quarter wave radiator. Not really. It is a half wave resonator that does the radiating. And so what we do with the left hand side, the great big ground plane side, the crazy way we shape it, how we space it above the ground, those are our choices. Those are some of our engineering things that we play with. But every real antenna, in the case of a rubber duck, you think the rubber duck is electronically a quarter wave long. The rest of that metal package and that handy-talkie that's in your hand is the other half of that dipole. It's not the same looking, but it's much bigger and it's got some lossy item called a watery hand holding onto it. I'm calling it a watery hand because 80 or 90% of the human being is made out of water. You're holding onto that the metal package, the second half of the dipole of your handy-talkie with that rubber duck, you're holding that in your hand. You become part of the ground plane radiating structure. So from that point of view, you suddenly realize that an awful lot of what you think is the magic of different kinds of antennas have a strong commonality to them. And as long as you got the right balance, as long as you got the right impedance match, as long as you make it out of low-loss materials, and as long as the lossy materials in the neighborhood are kept away from the antenna, in other words, I, in theory, could take a good half-wave dipole and bury a fraction of it below the ground in some sandy soil, so to speak. That's a lossy material, particularly if there's some moisture in that soil. And now, of the 100 watts I put into it, maybe 30 watts is radiated, 70 watts is heating up the soil. Those are some of the choices we make. But these are some of the step-by-step procedures that I'm using to give a little bit more understanding for what's going on with an antenna. I'll admit that some of this is radical-sounding understanding. Let me drop. Not everyone's going to agree with me, and I accept that. And even if I'm accurate, and even if there's some errors, it turns out that everything we know in physics is a mental model. We first learn about a hydrogen molecule or atom by saying it's got a single proton in the center and it's got an electron going around it in an orbit around it. Well, that's sort of true. And that model works 98% of the time. You get a little bit deeper into it and you find that that proton is not just a little blob in the center. It's made up of a certain number of quarks. And as you go up the periodic table, every one of those atoms, every one of those elements is really a lot more complicated than the model. But the model doesn't have to be perfect. If you're in my particular experiment, that model gives us the right answer 98% of the time, we're going to keep using that model. When it comes to this antenna understanding that I'm advocating these days, it is a model. It is a model that works for me, and it is part of the model that I've used mentally in order to form 17 patent applications for antennas in the last 6 years. And some of those have been granted, and some of those are manufactured products. So that model, simplistic as it may be, for me works, helps me understand what's happening, helps me design better antennas. I'm transferring some of that information, and you can decide what portion of the model you want to use. I know I didn't answer your question about this latest article in QST, but I'm just telling you how I'm beginning to look at the article, where I'm coming from with my particular viewpoint. Maybe it helps a little, and in future weeks we'll be having more and more discussions on this, I believe. Over to you, Bob. W2OSR, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Okay, W2OSR, yep. Well, I think we covered it. I'll let you go on to the next topic here, Dick. Back to you, W2OSR.
I'm guessing, Bob, that one of your questions was why in the world the article seems to be saying in one of the graphs that as you increase the number of ground plane radios, the efficiency appears to be going back down. And bear in mind that some of those efficiency plots are done for a particular elevation angle where he thinks the peak of beam is forming at that angle. And if you really have the three-dimensional pattern there, it really is what I call a bumpy apple. By that I mean the kinds of modern-day computer plotting programs that really plot the three-dimensional pattern, they have various colors and various shapes indicating in what portion of three-dimensional space is the signal the strongest. And because the strongest signal they usually make red and the weaker signal they usually make blue, it looks like an apple, and the apple's got a stem in it somewhere where there's a dip in the pattern where it turns from red to blue. And so these bumpy apple patterns, if we had those, it would be a little bit more understanding. So do you really get a decrease in efficiency or decrease in radiated power total when you go to a larger number of radials? I'm very doubtful of that, but I'm going to look at it more thoroughly. And so I'm guessing that that's one of the things that troubled you when you and I first read that article. Is that approximately true, Bob? Back to you.
To KEYR.
And to Exchange.
Okay, you got a couple of other people in there that make comments. Yeah, some of it didn't seem to follow the conventional wisdom, but what I'm thinking would take too long to discuss. I'll get into it at some other point. When you pick up the other gentleman, I'm going to go watch the Olympics. Back to net.
Very fine. Nice clean audio, Bob, but your audio is one third of the volume that it should be, in my opinion. Could be a lot louder. And if you're around later on tonight when we get deeper into some of these subjects, please come on back and we'll discuss all these other details that you think is going to be a little bit too elaborate right now. Both Mel and Wesley have further comments. Mel first, K2KEY. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY, because while you're on the subject, I have gotten a number of people that have asked me specific questions about similar situations with radials and understanding, or how do you measure, I think the word how do you measure, ground resistance losses. This seems to be the prominent, they say, show number of antennas, like inverted L's, Marconi's, different things. And it's mentioned about ground resistance. And so I never got to answer that question. So while you brought it up now, maybe you can say a few words about ground losses, Dick, over.
Yeah, ground to a radio signal is a very relative word. At many frequencies, you could assume the ground is a very good mirror, and that all signals get reflected in that mirror, very similar to what you see when you stand in front of the bathroom mirror when you're shaving in the morning, if you're male, or putting on your lipstick if you're female. You know what I mean. You could assume the ground is a mirror, and you'd come close. You could also assume the ground is only a partially silvered mirror, that some of the signal penetrates, and the image you get is a little bit dimmer than the original, and that would be coming close. So Earth has got a kind of a lossy component to it. One of the methods that have been used to give a beginning of a measurement is to sink ground rods into the ground, some particular depth, some particular length, some particular diameter of rods, some spacing between those rods, and make the right kind of an ohmmeter-like measurement. And you got to be careful. You don't just simply put an ohmmeter between those two rods and measure what you think is ground resistance, because your ohmmeter tends to put a positive current into one lead and a negative current in the other, and that eventually creates a kind of galvanic action where some local ions get built up around the rods. And so when you first make contact, you'll get one ohmmeter reading, and as you leave that contact there for a long enough period of time, you'll get a different reading. And so to get around that, some people will make a alternating current ohmmeter instead of a direct current ohmmeter. That helps. But now you're making a measurement at very low frequencies, essentially DC, or you might make that measurement at 60 cycle AC, your ground resistance measurement. And how much does that relate to a zillion times higher in frequency, up at 3.5 megacycles or 35 gigahertz? And so a lot changes as a function of frequency. Depth of penetration of the RF signal, absorptivity, reflectivity, phase shift, Brewster angle effects, and so on. It goes on and on and on. And the ground, let me drop. When you're making that measurement with those ground rods, you might be simplistically assuming that the ground is a uniform material at every inch and every foot as you go down. Well, almost all of the earth that's around your and my house doesn't fit that requirement. You may have some nice topsoil on top with moisture in the grass. You go down a little bit further, you're getting some sand. You go a little bit further, you're getting some clay. You go a little bit further, you get a higher rock percentage. So it has different resistivities, different volumetric resistivities at different depths. And how far does the RF energy go down, and what does it really see? It gets complicated. If you know that the soil in your backyard falls into one of the normal classifications of clay, sand, loam, topsoil, whatever, you can plug those pieces of information into modeling programs that do a little bit better job of calculating what's going to happen. But it's far from simple. Like everything else, if you think the problem is simple, you probably don't understand the problem. It'd be nice to think that everything in the world is simple and that engineers just keep making it complicated. That's not what's going on. The real world is complicated. You can gloss it over and attempt to make it, let me drop. You can gloss it over and attempt to make it as simple as you like. And sometimes you get in a lot of trouble when you do that. When you teach your pilots nothing but Bernoulli's principle and no other variation in theory as to how a wing develops lift, then you're going to get some accidents like Flight 587 that crashed into Far Rockaway and the Alaskan Airlines flight back in 2000, roughly, that crashed into the water outside of Los Angeles. In those particular cases, in my opinion, the pilot had insufficient knowledge of what the wing was really doing and therefore made decisions that turned out to be fatal. That's a strongly felt opinion. So what I'm getting at is most things are a little bit more complicated than you'd like them to be. That's just the way it is. You have to sort of accept that. But ground is not an easy subject, and the word ground is very relative. If you're on the third floor of an apartment building and you try to establish a good high-frequency ground for your antennas, are you doing that grounding for lightning protection? Yes. Are you doing it for human protection to make sure that your equipment can't develop an internal short circuit so the chassis gets hot with a 110-volt line and you touch that chassis and touch a water pipe and put yourself at risk? Are you putting a ground on to protect yourself from that? Yes. And the third area, are you putting on the ground to control radio frequency performance? That's the peculiar one. If you're on the third floor of an apartment building and you want a good RF ground on that equipment, are you sure you really need it? If the antenna itself is sufficiently symmetric, fed with the right kind of balancing device, it requires no RF ground to give full performance. And if you established an RF ground, you may think you're going to lower the amount of television interference. 98% of the time, I think the answer is no. That's not where it's coming from. So many of us will read the simple articles in some of the good books that tell us you should have a good RF ground. Do you really need it? And will it really make a difference when you're on the third floor or the second floor of a building? There's a lot to be discussed there, a lot more to it. Wesley's got some comments on all of the above. N2XJN, go right ahead, Wesley. K2RIW on the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Okay, this is November to X-ray, Juliet November. I think I would like to sign to the net. I was trying to sign, but my microphone was out. So I have a subject to discuss. But you mentioned something about the atoms and the electrons. And it looks like maybe I did understand you improperly, but you're actually going against the second law of thermodynamics, because the comment that you have made looks like I could explain it that the atom has constant spin and the electrons within the atoms are constantly spinning and there is no entropy, and the electromagnetic field energy is constantly being drawn. So it looks like that's what you were going against is proof the perpetual motion. Unless I understood the comment improperly, back to you.
I think you're referring to what I describe as the current buildup that occurs when you make the antenna a resonant length, and the charge that your feed line puts onto that antenna bounces back and forth. Let me put it from another set of point of view. And yes, the current building up appears to be a violation of conservation of energy if you look at it too simplistically. What I am saying is that every antenna you and I are likely to use, Wesley, I believe has a finite Q. By Q, I mean it has a finite rise time. If you suddenly abruptly put RF energy into the antenna, if you abruptly discontinue the signal into the antenna, with good instrumentation that you and I have owned from time to time, you can measure the discharge time. The signal does not instantaneously stop just because you turned off the transmitter, so to speak. There's some given number of cycles or thousands or millions of cycles that continue to come out of that antenna. It's got a finite rise time, a finite rise fall time. It's got a real Q. An ordinary dipole in free space, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe it has a Q of 10 or 20. And the word Q has about four or five interconnected definitions. One of the definitions of Q of a resonant circuit is the voltage rise that occurs at resonance. Another definition is the current rise that occurs at resonance. In both cases, I'm saying you're putting charge on the antenna, it's bouncing back and forth, if the antenna is resonant at the frequency you're driving it, all of those bounces back and forth stay in step, and they stay in step with the energy that your feed line is continuing to put onto that antenna. So you get a buildup of energy. Call it the ringing of a bell if you like, call it the resonant energy in the antenna, but there's a finite Q. And I'll tell you, let me go with some of those other definitions. Q is defined as the voltage rise at resonance, the current rise at resonance, the center frequency defined, divided by the bandwidth. That's another definition of Q. There's also a definition of Q with reference to the amount of energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. All of these definitions are tightly interconnected with each other. You could say there's four or five definitions for Q, or you could say there's one definition for Q and four or five different ways of analyzing it, understanding it, or measuring it. All of those statements have a degree of truthfulness to it. But that antenna, unless you've got an antenna that's, let me drop, unless you've got an antenna that's a zillion wavelengths long, like a rhombic antenna or a beverage antenna, with the exception of those antennas, any of the antennas that we build that are a small number of wavelengths in size are, by definition, a standing wave structure. The rhombic antenna is a traveling wave structure. In theory, the signal goes down that wire once, hits the 600 ohm resistor at the far end, and what you radiate good and what's left over gets dissipated. That's a rhombic antenna, a traveling wave antenna. 98% of all the antennas we amateurs use are standing wave structures. The signal is bouncing back and forth at least 10 times, if not more, on the thing that we call antenna. That gives it the finite Q, that gives it the ability to build up current. The buildup of current at resonance, because all those bounces are in step, allows you to make a stronger magnetic field. The stronger magnetic field allows you to radiate that energy. Radiation is hard. You send that signal down the dipole once and dissipate it at the far end by putting load resistors, your dipole will have a very small fraction of the gain it could have had because the signal doesn't jump into space on the very first pass. These are three or four different ways of me saying what I'm trying to say as to what happens when a dipole radiates a signal. Am I violating conservation of energy and whatever from that point of view? Do you believe, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is November 2X, Ray Juliet, November. In order for me to put the stand on it, what I need from you is just think reverse way. Sending wave ratio in terms of receiving antenna, not the antenna that is transmitting. Does it exist or does not? Back to you.
Okay. Okay, you used a magic word there, Wesley, and it's called standing wave ratio. And there's two entirely different standing wave ratios that you and I should be discussing. Number one is the standing wave ratio that occurs on the transmission line. If my transmission line was 50 ohms impedance, for instance, and if my antenna at the far end of that transmission line presented an impedance of 50 ohms of pure resistance with no reactants left over, then all that signal will go down the transmission line, hit the antenna. In theory, all of it gets absorbed by the antenna. I'm not saying how many cycles it takes to do that, but in the steady state, the antenna absorbs all of that energy. None of it reflects down the transmission line. Therefore, you and I would say that is a one-to-one standing wave ratio or a reverse voltage transfer ratio, S11 parameter on the network analyzer, would be minus infinity in decibels. No energy comes back. So that's a low standing wave ratio on the transmission line. In that nearly ideal system that I just described, that you and I can build, we can come very close to that. If I now measure the apparent standing wave ratio on the wire of the dipole itself, that standing wave ratio on the wire is extremely high, at least 10 to 1. The charge of energy you launch onto that antenna is bouncing back and forth many times. On the wire, the standing wave ratio is high. I think I know what you're about to say. How in the world can the standing wave ratio on the transmission line be 1 to 1? And a couple of inches later, I'm now analyzing the wire of the dipole itself, and the standing wave ratio is very high. Of course, that sounds crazy. But if it wasn't a high standing wave ratio on the wire, if the signal only went down the wire once and got radiated into space, then there would be nothing magic about the length of the wire. I could make the wire, instead of 132 feet long, I make it 142 feet long. Nothing would happen, because the first 132 feet would radiate the signal. It would all be gone. There'd be nothing to bounce back. I would see no standing wave ratio. You and I have a very hard piece of life evidence that tells us if I take that 132 foot long piece of wire as a dipole, nice and high in the air, on 80 meters, and I add 10 feet of wire on the end of it, you and I would now measure a very high standing wave ratio. That antenna is out of resonance. If you think about it, that's a very strong piece of evidence that the signal did not go down the wire once and jump into space. Because if it did, there would be nothing left over. The last 10 feet of wire, the signal wouldn't see it. There would be no change in the standing wave ratio. You and I, when we add that 10 feet of wire, the standing wave ratio climbs very high, very fast. We've knocked the antenna out of resonance. Therefore, the signal's got to be bouncing back and forth, or that would not have happened. N2XJN, do you agree or disagree? K2RIW on the TechNet.
N2XJN, yes, I do agree, Dick. But if you take right now the different scenario, you're bombarding the antenna with 10 watts outside. Let's say, just for the sake of theory, there's a 10 watts on the dipole, and you're trying to deliver this 10 watts of the signal to the receiver. Now, are you dealing without transmitting any power, with sending wave ratio, or you not? Back to you.
Okay, you and I put 10 watts down our transmission line into our dipole antenna to radiate it into space so that some other fellow amateur, some number of miles or 1,000 miles away, receives that signal on his similar antenna, and now that signal goes into his receiver, moves his signal strength meter, comes out of his loudspeaker or his headphones, and he says, "Hello, Wesley, thank goodness you're here. I haven't heard from you for a long time." The standing wave ratio of an antenna on transmit and the standing wave ratio on antenna on reception, for the most part, are equally important. And because of the law of reciprocity, which says that almost every passive, finite, low-loss antenna that doesn't have active amplifiers inside of it, and doesn't have circulators and other nonlinear devices. Any reasonable antenna will obey the law of reciprocity, which my definition of law of reciprocity, my understanding of it, is that whatever properties you measure on transmit, efficiency, standing wave ratio, pattern, peak-to-valley ratio, ellipticity, circular polarization, polarimetry, reflection, any of the parameters of an antenna that you and I can measure on transmission, it will have essentially the identical parameters, the exact same numbers on reception. So therefore, transmission and reception is just sort of your and my understanding of which way the signal is flowing now, but the effect should be the same. And on reception, the antenna does not build up. Let me drop for a second. If I had the ability to radiate that signal into space with an extremely fast rise time, and then I go over to your receiving antenna in Queens, and I watch how fast the signal builds up on your antenna, I would find your antenna has the exact same rise time on reception as it did on transmission. And if I had the ability to instantaneously turn off the signal radiated by my antenna, so if the signal radiated in space stopped in a nanosecond or a picosecond, and I measure how fast the signal dies on your reception antenna, I would see a slow decay. The rise time and fall time on transmission, the rise time and fall time on reception would be the same. The Q of your antenna when you're transmitting and the Q of your antenna when you're receiving is one and the same. So transmission and reception are not really different. It's just a function of which way is the signal flowing in my method of measurement or analysis right now. N2XJN, K2RIW. Wait for beep.
Okay, this is November to X-ray Juliet November. The Newtonian principle dedicated object in the motion, stay in the motion unless acted upon by another force. Well, that sounds like opportunity. No, I'm sorry, like perpetual motion. But at the same time, this signal comes to the antenna, used as the word dies. Well, inside the very atom itself, there is a constant spinning with no input of energy, no entropy. And that puts out electromagnetic energy. The electrons are also in perpetual motion. That's what I was trying to say at the end of that. And to XJS.
Yeah, Wesley is now getting into one of the really big paradoxes that started giving people trouble in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, and 1900s. When you study individual atoms, a hydrogen atom, an oxygen atom, a nitrogen atom, or molecule, and you realize it's got a nucleus of some number of protons and neutrons, and it's got this cloud of electrons flowing around them, and that cloud of electrons is moving very fast, something like the speed of light, in a circular orbit, in theory, those circular orbits of those electrons, you would think, are radiating energy. And therefore, each of these molecules should eventually run down and collapse. And they absolutely do not. And why not? That's not an easy one to answer. So that cloud of electrons that's going around an individual nucleus of a particular atom does not radiate that circular energy. It looks like perpetual motion. Somehow, way back at the Big Bang, this all got started, that particular electron is still going around that particular proton on that particular hydrogen atom, and he keeps doing it for the next zillion years. And he doesn't radiate that energy if you leave him alone. And so, yes, that does look like perpetual motion. And by the way, later on, one of the discussions that we've had now for a couple of weeks, and I'm pretty sure it's going to continue tonight, Wesley has been looking at machines that have excess energy. You put a certain amount of energy in, and you get more energy or work back out. And Wesley has collected quite a number of articles that you can go to, websites which demonstrate this. A number of them that he mailed to me recently came from Mr. Peter Lindman. And he showed a very nice magnetic rotary machine, let me drop, where He changed the way he was sucking energy back out of the machine, and so he was increasing the loading of the machine, so to speak, and the power put into the machine went down instead of up. And so at first that's a difficult thing to explain. I looked at quite a few of those, and I think I've got an explanation for what's going on. It might not be magic, but I could be wrong. So Wesley's been looking into these, and if you like science, and if you like studying science, and quite a few of these guys have been making machines, writing articles, collecting money, selling videos, selling plans on how to build these things, and are they perpetual motion? Maybe not. Are they really getting excess energy, free energy? They think so. Many people are skeptical. It's a fun thing to look into, and it's a there's a beautiful carrot at the end of that particular tunnel. If it turned out to be true, where I can put 100 watts into a machine and get 200 watts back out of it, and I use that to run the power that I need for my house, that would be an awful nice thing to have. I can see why many people are seeking it, and there's a large number of people who say, I don't think it's real. I think it's measurement error for people saying that. In the process of studying this, if you like that kind of science, it can be a lot of fun. Wesley has been looking at that. We're going to be hearing about that later on. I'm going to go to the next person who signed in tonight. And by the way, the discussions that Bob, W2ILP, had late into the wee hours last Sunday, and some of the discussions that Wesley and I and Glenn, KC2QIQ, have had, we get pretty far into this. And we think we're arriving at a higher truth. And some of the people listening to us think we're crazy. That's your judgment. KC2, Tango Delta Lima. John, you got it next. Go right ahead with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
All right. I had recently read an article about electrosmog, transients, you know, stuff that is pretty much background radiation that is harmful. Now, you know, I know it comes geologically from the Earth, but also increasingly it's coming from power lines, you know, electrical lines, CRTs, monitors, computers, just electronic stuff in general. And, you know, I'm sitting here in a room filled with many electrical wires above my head. I'm in my basement. I have the radio in front of me. I have the power supply next to me. I actually have a CRT monitor and a computer off, but right directly in front of me. And there's also a telephone. And, you know, I was just, you know, wondering, you know, what are the effects of these transients? You know, should we really be incredibly worried about them, although they are inevitable? Should we, you know, be more... should we protect ourselves more from transients from outer space? Is digital radio waves worse than analog radio waves? You know, is static electricity harmful? You know, just call my interest in this article about, you know, transients. And the funny thing was that I read it while my laptop was on my lap, and they talked against that. So, you know, what's your input on this?
Wow. Hey, John, you asked the $64,000 question. What is safe? First of all, for any of those signals to go from point A to point B in the air or in the vacuum of space, so to speak, I could simplistically say every one of those signals that you and I worry about is a kind of radio signal. And what we're really discussing here is radio frequency biohazard. And could you still call the 60-cycle power magnetic field coming from those high-tension lines that go by your house a mile away? Is that a radio signal? Yes, in a way it is, way down at a very low frequency, 60 cycles per second. Is 60 cycles a radio signal? Absolutely. Very, very different one, but it really is. So we're really talking about radio frequency biohazard. And I could also throw in there nuclear radiation hazards and so on. When in doubt, read what you can, make measurements when in doubt, and try to live a safe life. That's, of course, a conservative thing to do. And now you've got a cost-to-benefit ratio of everything you do. 40,000 people in America die per year in their automobile. That's a lot of death. And probably another 150,000 people get maimed. That's a lot of carnage, a lot of blood flow. If you were a super conservative person, you'd say we should never use automobiles. Well, a smart person says, I get a great benefit out of that automobile. It allows me to go from Port Jefferson to Queens if I want to, where I've got a much better job, I get a much higher pay, I climb back in that automobile, and I drive home. And as long as I take a defensive driving course, as long as I'm a conservative driver, as long as I have good insurance and a driver's license, I can make the risk-to-benefit ratio very, very low. In other words, the chances of me getting into one of those accidents, I can make it very, very low if I'm smart enough. Should I completely give up automobiles? Probably not. Probably not. If you insist on, in 2010, only getting to your job by way of a bicycle because you think it's safer, well, an awful lot of people go onto a bicycle, get hit by an automobile, and is it really safer? Probably not. A well-formed steel cage around you with the right kind of an automobile could be a hell of a lot safer than a bicycle. Let me drop for a minute. So I'm just using automobiles as an example. Huge risk-benefit ratio worth considering. That cell phone you put against your head, it's putting RF energy into your body. You might be living next door to a cell phone base station. 5 miles away, there may be a television broadcast station. 4 miles away, there may be an FM broadcast station. The fluorescent lighting, the solid-state ballast that it's got is radiating a 40 kilohertz signal. The power wiring in your house is radiating signals. And where's the threshold of safety is what I think you're really asking. And so what I think you're going to find out when you study it enough, John, that 99.9% of what you do, what has already been approved by the government, what has already been studied for 60 solid years by way of the ANSI report, ANSI, American National Standards Institute, a division of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, the C95 report, Charlie 95 Echo, I think is the latest version. That particular report represents 60 years of solid research by the best testing laboratories, the best institutions, the best smart people on planet Earth. And there is a similar document for the Radiological Protection Board for the United Kingdom. There's a similar document printed in Germany, in Japan, Australia, in whatever. Every one of those countries are studying these exact subjects. You take the American report, the C95 report, and you look at the back of it, there's 450 well-documented references where people did real experiments, in many cases on real animals, and tested how much danger there really is. Let me drop. So this is very, very different than what happened in the bad old days of where we didn't worry about asbestos and we suddenly discovered it was very dangerous. We didn't worry about cigarette smoking. We suddenly discovered it was very dangerous. A naive person in 2010 living in Bayville will say, well, we thought radio signals are safe and we suddenly found out they're not. People in Bayville are saying that. I think they're in error. They didn't realize that 60 years of research has gone on. It is not a brand new subject. And so a hell of a lot of what we do is really very safe, really been studied. And now when you research the subject, you got to be careful. The Internet and Wikipedia and whatever can give you a tremendous amount of information. And 98% of that information is real good stuff. But there's a couple of nut papers out there. There is a particular professor with some rather nice credentials in Paris, France, who has published a series of articles saying that cell phone base stations are dangerous and they're harming people in the neighborhood where they're mounted. He has been saying this. And so the people who do research very selectively, only looking for the bad news and not the good news, and they land on that particular French professor, and they say, aha, he sounds like he's right. I'm now going to sue my town to remove all of the radiating signals, all of the radio antennas. I'm going to remove them from my town in Oyster Bay Township. There are people who have made that exact decision. They've hired attorneys. Three separate lawsuits are going on right now in parallel, simultaneously in the town of Bayville, trying to remove every single cell phone antenna, every fire and police and ambulance antenna from that town because the people believe they're protecting their children from this harmful radiation. The word radiation is what's scaring them. Let me drop. Way back in the early 1900s, when we discovered how radio works, we discovered that you put a signal into a good antenna, and it goes out in all directions. The signal radiates. So the process of sending out a signal got called radiation. Pretty good word. It accurately described it. The dictionary definition of radiation tells you what it does. Along came World War II, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, atomic bombs, and now we had nuclear radiation. Very, very different. Apple and orange. You can't compare the two. Very, very different. Nuclear radiation is very dangerous, and some people who are super conservative will say every dose of nuclear radiation is an overdose. And then they jump and say, well, this stuff is called RF radiation. Every dose is an overdose. Absolutely wrong. The ANSI report gives you very specifically defined, clearly evaluated MPEs, maximum permitted exposure levels, of approximately 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. Keep all of your RF energy below 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, which is equivalent to 100 watts going into your antenna, and you're more than 5 feet away from it, so to speak. That's approximately where it works out. Stay more than 5 feet away from your HF antenna that has 100 watts into it. I'm rounding off the numbers tremendously, but I'm giving you ballpark figures. You will be below that minimum, maximum permitted exposure, and you'll be safe. If you decide to do a dangerous experiment, you put a kilowatt antenna into that antenna, you mount yourself 1 foot away from the antenna, leave your eyes open, stay there key down for 6 solid minutes, because the way the RF energy works is that it only creates heating. They've looked for many, many other effects, and they essentially cannot find them. It's only a heating effect. So in the eyes of the most vulnerable part of the human being, you sit in front of that antenna 1 foot away with a kilowatt going into it, and you stay there for 6 solid minutes. That's how long it takes to heat up your eye, so to speak. There's a chance you could create some eye damage if you did that. As you can see, it takes a whole lot of crazy things piled on top of each other. A key down transmitter with a brick on the key, a lot of power going into the antenna, you sitting very close to the antenna and staying there with your eyes open for 6 solid minutes. You do all that, you're beyond the threshold of those maximum permitted exposures, and you might, at certain frequencies...
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. Net tonight at 8 o'clock.
You do all that, and you might create biological damage to yourself. But that's a pretty foolish experiment. Nobody in his right mind is going to do that. And by the way, if a child is using a flashlight under the covers to look at a comic book when he should be sleeping, and if the child was foolish enough to take a modern krypton flashlight, krypton bulb type flashlight, and hold that flashlight directly against his closed eye and look at the light shining through his eyelid, and if he did that for 6 minutes, the flashlight could possibly create damage to his eye. Should we outlaw all flashlights? Should we outlaw all transmitters? Should we remove all antennas from our town and abandon the radio dispatching services that allow you to send out the police, the fire, ambulance, and cell phones? Of course, that would be foolish. You gotta weigh the goods with the bads. So I recommend you do good web research, but be careful. There's a little bit of bad data out there. Make sure you're using data that has been peer-reviewed, or data that has been approved by the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. That's one very good organization. The American Medical Association, another one. The AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Read the good books. Read the good articles, Scientific American, among others, and you'll discover that an awful lot of what you think is unsafe, used within reason, is very, very safe. Nothing is perfectly safe. When you got out of bed this morning, you took a risk. There's a chance that just walking to your car with the ice on the road, you could slip and fall and do some damage to yourself. There's risk in everything. And you have to accept a certain degree of risk. But still, I think you're going to discover that within reason, all of your electrical appliances, all the wiring of your house, the cell phone you're using, the car that you're driving, if you drive it safely, I think you're going to eventually discover that every one of these things have more than a reasonable amount of safeness if you use them with good common sense. I know this is only a thumbnail sketch of the whole issue. It's not an easy issue that you've asked, John. You've asked a darn good question. A lot of people are asking the question. Keep asking it. Keep researching it. Keep finding out more data. And as you find out that data, tell it to your neighbors, tell it to your relatives, let them know the full story, because an awful lot of the people don't understand the technology that they're using every day, therefore they're afraid of it.